Scientists who study the stars say that life on Earth has an expiration date because even if nothing else happens, someday the sun will go dark. Long before that happens, will astronomers be able to find some place for Earthlings to go? In recent years, the search for planets outside our solar system that might harbor life has become the fastest growing branch of astronomy. NASA's Kepler spacecraft has identified 3,500 potential planets in one tiny neighborhood of the Milky Way. Coming up, science journalist Lee Billings and Hopkins astronomer Peter McCullough on the search for life among the stars. The timeless question, are we alone? First, the news. This is Midday. Dan Rodericks, thanks again for joining us for our second hour. Unless you've been living on another planet for the last half century, you've probably wondered whether there is life on other planets. If you get your science from the movies, you may think of extraterrestrial life as Jabba the Hutt or those nasty bugs from Starship Troopers. If you get your science from science books, you might be satisfied with finding a planet that hosts a one-celled organism the size of an amoeba. Although amoeba-like critters are far more likely than killer ants with ray guns, a growing body of evidence suggests we're at a unique point in history when we can reasonably hope to discover that we're not alone in the universe. My guests this hour have both done a lot of thinking about what might live out there in other galaxies on faraway planets. Lee Billings is a journalist whose work has appeared in the nation's top general interest science publications. In a fascinating new book, 5 Billion Years of Solitude, he tells the story of this search and the people who dedicate their lives to it. 5 Billion Years of Solitude refers to the life expectancy of the biosphere that gives us life, about 80% of which is over. But don't worry, that still gives us 500 million years to work on it. Meanwhile, Lee Billings says, the last 2 decades have seen giant strides in figuring where our neighbors might hang out. It's no easy feat, because our brief glimpses of exoplanets in deep space from missions like the Kepler spacecraft or the Hubble telescope show us what they were like thousands or even millions of years ago, because that's how long it took the light from their stars to reach us. What are those planets like now? Who knows? If we were an advanced race poking around the universe 1 billion years ago, would we spot the unpromising chunk of rock we inhabit today and say, hey, that's worth a visit? And even though life may turn out to be common in the universe, creatures like us probably aren't, and technological societies would be even more scarce. So even with the best efforts of scientists at SETI, that's the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, SETI, they scan galactic radio signals for signs of life, Lee Billings says the likelihood of contact is remote at best. But try they must, and Lee Billings tells the story of that search through scientists like Frank Drake, the radio telescope pioneer who has tried to reach out to other galaxies with transmissions from Earth, or Jim Casting, the Penn State geoscientist who's figured out what it takes to make a planet habitable, and Sarah Seeger, the MIT astronomer who studies the chemical signatures of their atmospheres and won a MacArthur Genius Grant last year. Lee Billings is a journalist whose work appears in distinguished publications such as Nature, New Scientist, Popular Mechanics, Scientific American. Again, the name of the book is 5 Billion Years of Solitude, The Search for Life Among the Stars, available from Current Books. The reviewer of the New York Times said, Lee Billings' story may meander at times, but this is the best book I have read about exoplanets and one of the few whose language approaches the grandeur of a quest that is practically as old as our genes. The Search for Life Among the Stars, 5 Billion Years of Solitude. Lee Billings, welcome to Planet Baltimore and the Midday Show.
Dan, thanks for having me so much and for that masterful introduction. Very thorough.
Okay. We're also lucky enough to have with us today someone intimately associated with the search for Earth-like planets, because he does that for a living here in our own backyard, Peter McCullough, an associate astronomer at the Space Telescope Science Institute, which is located on the campus of the Johns Hopkins University. The Space Telescope Science Institute operates the Hubble Telescope. And Peter McCullough, so welcome to the show, and thank you for reading Lee's book for us, too, and coming in today.
Well, thank you for having me.
So, Lee, what got you to this project? I guess this is just the big question, isn't it? It's the question everybody has. Are we alone? But what specifically brought you to this project, this book?
Well, I think you're right. It is kind of a timeless question that everyone thinks about every now and then. And of course, I can trace it back to my own involvement, just to simply looking up at the sky and wondering what was out there, just like everyone else has done in their life. But really, this specific book and this specific topic and the notion of the exoplanet boom that we're finding so much so quickly, and we're on the cusp of this amazing discovery, came to me back in 2007. I was talking with an astrophysicist at the University of California, Santa Cruz, named Greg Laughlin. And he had me do a very simple exercise, and he just had me graph essentially the record holder for the lowest mass exoplanet that we knew each year. And if you track that year by year, you'll see there's this amazing progression where we used to be finding things that were like Jupiter size, and that was kind of the best we could do. And then year by year, we're finding smaller and smaller things and more potentially habitable orbits, things that could be like Earth. And he had me graph this out. And if you draw a trend line through the data, you would see back in 2007 that we were going to be finding Earth mass planets circa 2011. And I saw that, and I just, it was like the scales fell from my eyes, and suddenly I had this epiphany that, you know, wow, this is a huge story, and it seems like not many people are really talking about it or aware of it. And I had this sense that somewhere on the planet, out of the 7 billion or so people who are on planet Earth, there were a handful of individuals who would go down in history and would be remembered maybe hundreds or thousands or even longer periods of time, thousands of years from now, for being the first people to go out and find habitable planets and maybe find life out there. So I thought that's really important. I should try to go talk to these people, tell their stories, and that's what the book's about.
Peter McCullough, in this regard, could you just tell us what is Hubble providing in this regard in terms of exoplanets?
Well, Hubble is very good at following up discoveries by other instruments. Hubble can measure, for example, the atmospheres of large planets circling other stars.
And what are you finding?
Well, we found water. That's one of the big discoveries of the last year or two. We see water in the atmospheres of Jovian-sized or Jupiter-sized planets, and water's to be expected there, but it's nice to see it.
Lee Billings, to the title of your book, I don't usually ask authors about this, but this is such an intriguing title, 5 Billion Years of Solitude. I certainly don't feel very alone here on Earth, but you're talking about something else.
That's right. And I should say that, you know, with apologies to Gabriel Garcia Marquez, it wasn't a deliberate ripoff. I've gone back since and realized there's actually some interesting tonal similarities between the two books. But yeah, it's kind of trying. The title is basically trying to express, I guess, something of a little sadness and a little feeling of bittersweetness that we're poised on the cusp of these amazing discoveries. And yet it depending on who you ask, depending on your point of view, it may be quite some time before we actually go out and make these discoveries, if we make them at all. And naturally, there's a little bit of sadness involved with that. We want to go find other things like us. We want to look out into the cosmos and feel some sort of significance about our lives, finding a better sense of where we stand to this big thing. And the fact that we could go do that and maybe we aren't going to is a little tragic, I think. And I hope that's actually not the case.
Oh, we're going to find them.
We're going to find them.
This is Peter McCullough.
Yeah.
We may not find them today or tomorrow or next year or even this decade coming up, but we're certainly going to find them, and I hope in my lifetime, but I'm not confident of that. But I think it was also in your book, we need to step away from our human timescale and think on longer timescales, societal timescales. And in that timescale, I'm very confident that we will find evidence of life on other planets.
I want to ask you both this question. If you can step out of the astronomer role just for a minute, just be a man on Earth.
Yep.
And Lee Billings, same for you. Just hold off being the science journalist for a minute. Be a man on Earth. And I've had this thought many times that it's impossible for us to be unique. That whenever it all happened, the Big Bang or whatever, it seems so unlikely to me that in all that mass out there, all that space and time and density and everything else that's out there, that we would just what happened on this planet would be unique. So I'm just speaking as a guy on planet Earth. So Peter?
Well, I'd be interested to hear what Lee says, but my perspective is very similar to what you just described. The numbers of stars is incomprehensible to a simple human mind. And the distances separating those stars are also incomprehensibly large. I think of this very much like my dog. I don't expect my dog to be able to understand what I do at work. But humans could be like that to the great questions, these great distances and these great numbers of stars. But if you just do the mathematics of adding all that up, I agree with you. It seems very incomprehensible that we would, inconceivable, that we would be the only life forms and even the only sentient life forms in the universe. On the other hand, the distances are very large, and that is the challenge, that we may be alone in the sense that we never able to communicate with any of these life forms.
Lee, I'd like your thoughts on that.
I'm going to go ahead and agree with Peter in the sense that the question for me, and I think for most people, is not so much whether or not we are alone, it's whether or not we are practically alone. And the question is not, does other life, other intelligent life even exist in the universe? It's how far away is that life? How far away is that intelligent life? And can we have any hope of detecting it? So you have to remember, in some sense, when we're thinking in particular about intelligent life, when we're looking out into the depths of space, because precisely there are so many stars, because there is so much space, because there is a finite speed of light, and you're essentially looking back in time when you look way, way, way far out in space. So in some sense, when you think about that, we're not just looking – we're not really looking for ourselves. We're not looking for someone – you know, people having a radio conversation like we are right now necessarily. We're kind of looking for our big futures, our possible futures, things that maybe we could do in the future to be detected across these interstellar, potentially even intergalactic distances. And when we do that, when we look out right now, we aren't looking very hard, but we sure don't see – a lot that looks very lively out there. It looks pretty dead and dark and cold. So I think that should make us really question our future and where we're going. And that's one reason, again, that goes back to the title, the 5 billion years of solitude notion. I would maybe somewhat challenge Peter on the notion that we're going to definitely go out and find these things, that we're definitely going to go build these really ambitious multi-billion-dollar space telescopes that will potentially deliver signs of life elsewhere. I think that we have to wonder about the trajectory of our society and our civilization. And if it's always this thing that's just continually progressing and going up and we're always getting better and better, I'm not really sure that's true. I hope it's true, but I don't know if it is.
Well, I agree with you that we cannot continue to grow our economies and the number of people and the activity on Earth as we have in the past century or centuries. And yet I don't think that's incompatible with the idea that a society comparable to our own would build the facilities to detect life on other planets. And in fact, we might get lucky. There could be life, for example, within our own solar system outside of the Earth, where we will find rather definitive evidence of life. I think beyond our solar system, the evidence will always be somewhat suspect because we can't touch it, we can't poke it, we can't feel it.
Unless we go there.
Unless we go there.
Yeah, and that's a long, long, long time in the future.
Hey, one last question about the uniqueness of Earth. You know, we define life here. Life here requires carbon and oxygen. So I wondered, is it possible that life out there could be based on other elements? Is that a theory, something someone researches, Lee? Or
I'll just simply say, obviously, I'm a lowly journalist, a mere journalist, not a scientist, but based on the folks I talk to, I mean, of course, there are these opportunities for alternate biologies and biochemistries, things that are based on silicon or that use, for instance, something besides water as a solvent. You can think about these things. You can conceive them in your mind. You can theoretically construct these things, and they seem to work somewhat. But we have to really, I think, start from what we know. We do have a sample size of one right now. For better or worse, life on Earth. And that's what we really know how to recognize. And we consequently, I think, have to kind of branch out from that. It's just an inevitable handicap that we're dealing with. But, you know, some people do think that there are really very solid thermodynamic reasons, physical, chemical reasons for us to look mostly for carbon and for water-based life. And so I'd be really interested to know what Peter thinks about that.
I think that silicon is a very good way to make life. And I think we're about to do that. And when I mean about, I don't mean this year again, but I mean in the societal timescale of a few generations. I think we will build computers that will become essentially sentient and lifelike. And that might be the natural evolution from biology to electronics. It's not my field. I'm just a guy in that regard. But it seems natural that that will occur.
That's the voice of Peter McCullough, associate astronomer at the Space Telescope Science Institute, which is located on the campus of Johns Hopkins University. They operate the Hubble telescope. If you have questions for Peter, please give us a ring, 410-662-8780. And our guest is Lee Billings, our other guest, a distinguished science journalist, whose book we're talking about in this hour of the show, 5 Billion Years of Solitude. Current Books is the publisher. 5 Billion Years of Solitude, The Search for Life Among the Stars. A short break. You're welcome to call with a question. We'll be right back. We have open phone lines for questions for our guest, Lee Billings, author of 5 Billion Years of Solitude, The Search for Life Among the Stars, and Peter McCullough, who's visiting us today from the Space Telescope Science Institute, which operates the Hubble telescope for NASA. So here's a question for both of you. I'll start with Lee on this, and then we'll go to Peter to add to it. I think our listeners would like to know from your book the major ways scientists are trying to determine whether there's life on other planets. Peter spoke briefly about Hubble's role in that, but let's open that up a bit more. What exactly is going on in the pioneering research is being done on exoplanets?
Sure, of course. Let's break that into two categories. There's detection and characterization. When I say detection, what I mean is just finding a planet. Characterization means finding out what that planet is actually like, what its environment is like. So planets are very small. They're very dim, very faint, and they're hugging a very bright, overwhelmingly bright star. So most of the time when people are finding planets, most of the planets that we found that we have in our catalog are actually detected indirectly. They're detected through looking at their stars and seeing how the planets actually affect their star's light. So we're looking at the dimming of a star or the wobbling of a star, things like that. And that's how we infer the presence of a planet. We can derive things like mass and orbit and its radius, maybe its density even, from these sorts of measurements. But that's, you know, you can really just write all that stuff on a note card, and that's all you're really going to know about the planet, maybe its age, things like that. So what you have to do to characterize it and really figure out what it's like is get some light from it, get some reflected light or emitted light somehow from that planet. And light has this very weird thing that it does where it carries information about the matter that it interacts with. So that's how we know that the stars out there are made of the same things that we are, for instance. It's imprinted in the light. And you get the light from the planet by maybe building one of these big space telescopes. There's various ways. Maybe even on the ground, and you can look for things like the signatures of, let's say, oxygen in its atmosphere, or water vapor, or methane, or carbon dioxide, things that here on Earth we associate with either habitable conditions, clement temperatures, the existence of liquid water, or life itself. Oxygen, for instance, is a product of photosynthesis in our atmosphere, green plants. So that's a big signal of life that we could potentially look for and that we have detected from very far away on our own planet.
Yes, I agree with all that. That's an excellent summary, Lee. I guess I can say historically, when I was a child, we had none of these planets. It was entirely unknown. Even whether we were alone in a physical sense, whether there was any physical planet like Earth orbiting any solar-like star. And now we know the answer to that, and Kepler has given probably the best answer to that, and it is that we are definitely not alone. There's planets, essentially, you look at up in the night sky, every star there, basically,
that's right,
has a planet. And that's real news. That's real breakthrough.
And this is recent stuff.
Pretty recent.
Yeah, even this last year.
Yeah, I mean, we keep finding more and more of them. The Kepler satellite was launched in 2009 or 10, I forget, so a few years ago. And it's been working about 4 years now to assemble these results. The life is going to be harder, but we're working our way there. We've already detected rather convincingly water vapor in some planets' atmospheres. These are Jupiter-sized planets, so not, again, terrestrial planets where we might hope to find little green men. But we make our way there, and I think the more intriguing aspect is that we stumble upon things in this adventure that we didn't anticipate. We're looking for one thing and we stumble upon something else that's more interesting sometimes.
And we're still listening too, right?
You mean listening for extraterrestrials?
Listening for sounds from space, radio telescopes?
Yes, in a very rudimentary way. I mean, the best technology that we can do, but in the scale of the problem, it's very rudimentary. And it is getting more and more difficult. In the days of Frank Drake, 30 or 40 years ago, as Lee outlines well in the book, there was a lot of possibility. You had no idea what was going on, so you might get lucky real easy. The problem might be easy. But it's been harder, and the long slog, and Jill Tarter, who I know well, has been leading the SETI Institute out in California and having a harder and harder time getting funding for that.
Yeah, I read in book, I was very interested to read about this man, Frank Drake. And folks, we'll go to the phone lines in just a moment, but there's just something I found kind of amusing about the Frank Drake story. This is, of course, the man who pioneered the search for radio signals from extraterrestrials. And he's concerned now that because we've gone digital, that we're not just, we're not making as much noise as we used to.
That's right. Our electromagnetic footprint, our echoes that ripple out into space have diminished in recent years. That's not necessarily saying that they're going to keep diminishing, but the real point of Drake's concern there is that he tried to predict the future back in the 1960s, and he was wrong. And it's going back to Peter's point. We are a little blinkered. We are looking for these Earth-like planets. We want to find mirror Earths out there, and we're looking for Earth-like life and things. But we have to – the fundamental thing of importance is just to gain the capability to really go out and look and make a really strong examination of whatever's around us. And inevitably, we will be surprised because so often predictions are not really in line with what actually happens.
And are we getting funding? What's going on there? I just wanted to touch on this briefly. I know it's been erratic over the years. It becomes politicized, of course. What would you say about that now, Lee?
Well, in some ways, it's very promising. In other ways, it's really, really dismal. And so let me just break that down a little bit. When I say it's promising, we have a wonderful, amazing piece of kit that's going to hopefully be launching in 2018 called the James Webb Space Telescope. And that could be transformative in a lot of ways. James Webb Space Telescope, it's going to be able to do very, very special things. It can, in some cases, it looks like, even look for things like water vapor and methane, which is a potential sign of life, on a handful of nearby planets that orbit stars smaller and dimmer than our own sun. So that's very encouraging. But I guess I'm kind of, again, in the skeptics camp and a little pessimistic about it. And I don't think it's going to take us where we really want to go, which is sampling a very large number of stars, a large number of potentially habitable planets around those stars and looking for signs of life. We're talking about a literal handful instead of, hundreds or thousands from which you can then do statistics. You can figure out whether or not you've just been lucky or unlucky. Again, if you think about a very similar problem as to what Drake and the other SETI folks were facing back in the day when they were pointing their telescopes at the sky. They didn't quite know what was out there, and they thought, well, maybe we'll get lucky. Maybe there's a civilization around every star. In that case, you don't need a big telescope. If you don't need a big planet-finding or life-finding space telescope or anything like that if there's life and Earths around every star. But if they're only around, one in every 50 or one in every 100 stars, then you're going to need something much, much bigger.
Peter.
Well, I think that I lost my train of thought while Lee was talking. I was looking at some monitor. It was distracting me here.
I'm sorry.
That's all right. My fault. I think now it's come back to me. It is not true that James Webb Space Telescope won't take us where we want to go. It'll take us on the journey. And the journey is what life's about. And it's going to answer some very important questions, both in exoplanets and the formation of galaxies and things like that. I agree with Lee, and I think this is actually what he was making the point about, is it will not answer the question of whether there is biology going on exoplanets. That will take more resources and longer time.
Let's go to the phone lines and take some questions. Folks are eager to ask questions of our guest, Peter McCullough, who was just speaking, an associate astronomer at the Space Telescope Science Institute over at Hopkins, operators of the Hubble Telescope for NASA. And Lee Billings is with us today, science journalist Lee Billings. His latest book, 5 Billion Years of Solitude, The Search for Life Among the Stars. John in Mount Washington, we'll start with you. Thanks for calling midday, John.
Thank you. My question is somewhat short. I mean, I overheard what you guys are talking about, and yeah, it's really, really incredible stuff with the exoplanet exploration. I mean, I've been following it. I think it was James Macy. Is that the guy? Not Macy. I'm sorry. The lead scientist who started this some years back in the late 90s. And he talked about how his people would laugh at him when he would mention he's looking for exoplanets, and then all of a sudden he did find them. Now it's becoming a major new turnaround. But my question to you is this. I know that we're using probes because they would make this sense for a vanguard, that is to go forward. But, again, with the expense of what it does cost to put a human being in space and all of the dangers, nevertheless, there would be people who would be willing to go and would want to go. So your best guess, gentlemen, from what you know already, do you think that there will be somewhere in the immediate future or not too distant future a renewed space effort that would go for a solar exploration as we would actually send men not only beyond Mars but to Europa, Enceladon, you know, Enceladus rather, to find whether or not there is bacterial life or sushi or something even bigger?
John, thank you. Manned missions.
I think that's quite likely that in my lifetime I'm in my 40s, and I think in my lifetime we will put a person or persons on Mars. I don't think that in my lifetime we will do that for the other planets that he mentioned, although they're excellent places to look, and in fact you may not want to send people there to make studies. And in an example of what I was saying about the journey and how we find surprises as we go along on this adventure, just recently we found water geysers squirting out of Europa. Now that's wonderful because that allows you to probe down underneath the ice by probing that water that's naturally squirting up out of it.
Lee, anything to add there?
I basically agree with what Peter said. I'm in my early 30s. I think that in my lifetime, I hope to see someone on Mars. Maybe it'll be Elon Musk walking around post, you know, retirement. Maybe it'll be someone from NASA or, you know, someone from China. Who knows? I think that's possible. I do also think that for other planets and other bodies in the solar system, it's going to be a little tougher other than the moon and Mars. And the one thing I would also say is that we can't discount just how much we can really do with technology and with remote controlled stuff these days. I think it's entirely feasible to think that maybe we'll have some sort of robotic creatures really that are very capable, almost as capable as human beings, that'll be jaunting around some of these other places.
Another call. This is Rick in Baltimore. Welcome to Midday.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Go right ahead, Rick.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment. I think 100% that there is something out there, another being of some sort. It's almost crazy these days not to believe there's something out there. But I think essentially we will never have contact with another life form, simply because people look at, you know, time as linear, hours, minutes, days, years, when in fact to find extraterrestrial life, we're talking light years. And to get a human body to even be that far out to physically explore would, you know, you'd have to rewrite quantum mechanics and take the body apart and put it back together somewhere else, because we can't survive that kind of travel.
But we have plenty of time to plan, don't we?
Right. I think we do have time to plan, but I think that, you know, prior to us being able to do something like that, something will happen to us, or we'll do something to ourselves to destroy this planet.
Yeah.
But essentially, I feel that what will happen, if anything does happen, is that we will get contacted by someone else. And it could have been sent a billion years ago. But I think that someone will contact us before we figure out how to go through wormholes and really figure out light speed.
Thank you, Rick. Peter?
I agree with that. I think the person to ET in-person touching kind of communication is not something I even think about, really. It's fun for movies and other science fiction. But I'm hoping that people like Jill Tarter hit the jackpot one day. I mean, she's basically buying a lottery ticket with the dollar that she gets from society. And maybe she will hit the jackpot and there will be a message, and it will be incontrovertible evidence that there is intelligent life out there. I think that's the short method to getting to that question. Mm-hmm. The long method is to pick away at it in terms of, can we find some biology somewhere? Well, can we study planets in many ways? And one way would be to see a biological signature, as Lee mentioned, oxygen. I think it's also true that the possibility may be that we are visited by others. I think that's a logical thing to think about. And in fact, if you ask most people in America, I think it's something like the majority already think we are visited by other people.
That's true.
I'm not one of them, but yeah. I think about it realistically. When we announce the detection of extraterrestrials, many people may shrug and go, I knew that.
Peter. Lee, did you want to add something there?
He basically said exactly what I would say.
I just want to add this. This was a note sent to me by our associate producer, Mike Himowitz. On that point I raised about Frank Drake, the pioneer of the search for radio signals from space, and I remember the movie Contact some years ago with Jodie Foster. Drake's worry is that Earth's own detectability in this regard has declined with the advent of digital television, a worrisome omen if this is the trend of advanced civilizations everywhere. I just want to share with you what Mike further said here. He says his take on this is that the fear is that if we all go to cable, aliens looking for intelligent life on their planets might not be able to see TV radio spectrum broadcasts of Gilligan's Island reruns and other radio TV shows that have been polluting the rest of the universe from earthly broadcasters' antennae for almost a century. Just as we search for patterns in the radio frequency traffic from other stars, aliens might make a determination of the viability of intelligent life on this planet based on somehow decoding those TV signals. At which point, they would immediately write off Earth as devoid of intelligent life or decide to destroy it and rid the universe of Duck Dynasty forever. So thank you very much, Mike Himowitz. A short break here on Midday. We'll come back, and less from me and more from our callers for Lee Billings and Peter McCullough. 410-662-8780. We'll be right back. Hey, Peter McCullough, before we go back to our phone lines for you and Lee Billings, what is the EXO project? That's what you're working on, right?
Yeah, EXO is my little project. We used to run out of a volcano in Hawaii on Haleakala, Maui, and now we have three sites that survey the sky every night looking for a planet to pass in front of its star, and it diminishes the light by the little silhouette of that black planet in front of the star. So we have three of those. One is in a volcano in the Canary Islands, and one is in the southwestern United States, and another one is in mainland Spain.
Thank you very much. Peter McCullough from the Johns Hopkins campus, but he's with the Space Telescope Science Institute. That's where they're based, operators of the Hubble telescope for NASA. And Lee Billings with us in this hour of midday, author of 5 Billion Years of Solitude, The Search for Life Among the Stars. Let's go back to the phone lines. Milton in Edgewood, you're up next. Thanks for calling Midday.
Thanks, Dan, taking my call.
Sure.
I couldn't help but hear in the beginning of this particular show, I'm 61 years old, so, you know, I come through Carl Sagan, and, you know, I have nothing but honor and respect and admiration for scientists and all smart people. No disrespect for people who are not so smart, but this thought was provoked when you mentioned the sun burning up. You know, you hear this all your life. The sun burning up and destroying the earth, and, you know, we need to find another place to live. And this is what hit my mind. I'm like, it's a kind of a comment / rhetorical question. Dan, we are not taking care of this planet. If I was a planet that was habitable out there somewhere, I would turn into a black hole so you can't find me. So we can't find me, right?
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
In the meantime, I don't think I'm alone in that, because we all know we are destroying this planet. If you don't mind, one more little thought that's not me by myself. This is what it says. It says, the time will come when thou shalt destroy them which destroy the earth. That's God talking. Mm-hmm. Now, that's not trying to preach to nobody, but mm-hmm. that's Revelation 11:18. The time will come when thou shalt destroy them destroying the earth. And me, again, I'm not trying to destroy nobody, but if I was out there and habitable, I wouldn't let us find me.
Thank you very much, Milton. You know, I was thinking about this when we were getting ready for the show, the point being made that, yeah, there is a expiration date on this planet, but it's very far off. However, we're doing our best maybe to accelerate that day when it comes. Let's hear from Lee on that.
Well, I'd like to let Milton know that, of course, there is some truth in Scripture in cases. We do know that the meek will inherit the earth, according to the Beatitudes, and that's because about 500 million years from now, it's going to get real hot from the sun getting slowly brighter over time. And yes, complex multicellular life, things like you and me, will have a lot of trouble then, probably, and the bacteria will be just fine for a while longer. You know, the thing is that this is we're talking about a spectrum of existence here. There is no cutoff point between our world and what's outside of us. I mean, there is in some sense. We have the atmosphere and things like that, but we're really all part of the same stuff. You know, so when we think about what's out there, that has deep implications for what's down here and how we live our lives. And one thing that I like to think about every now and then, it's a little pessimistic in terms of maybe the search for life and intelligence out there, but it's still a valid idea and it's important to consider, which is this. For hundreds of years now, the trend in physical sciences has been telling us that we're not important, we're not special, that we don't matter, we're not significant, we're average, we're ordinary, we're mediocre. That, you know, that whether you're looking at Darwin talking about evolution or Copernicus talking about the whole universe actually not revolving around the Earth, we've had existential demotion one after another from the physical sciences. Now, try to contemplate what would happen if we built one of these big space telescopes or maybe did things on the ground and looked at the nearest several hundred or several thousand stars, and we didn't really find much of anything to comment about, or at least we didn't find anything that we could talk to. We didn't find any signs of life, maybe not any signs of clearly habitable planets. Now, in some sense, people could see that as a defeat, and they'd say, oh, that's terrible. We spent all this money, and we didn't find what we were looking for. On the other hand, you could see it as kind of almost a call to action and something that we should really take to heart in our daily lives. If we realize and we have some confidence that in this huge bubble of space around us, there's nothing. At least nothing as interesting as what's going on here. So I think that if something like that did happen, and it's quite possible that could happen if we did actually go out and look, that could make us take better care of our own planet and live our daily lives somewhat differently, because we would realize that we are, in fact, slightly special, perhaps.
Interesting. Peter?
Well, I want to thank Milton very much for the question and the comment. I think it's a very profound statement he's made. And it is very difficult for us as simple humans to understand the damage we're doing to our environment and the risk that provides for our future. And one of the criticisms I would have of the book is sort of a nitpicky thing. But Lee talks about the clock running out 100 million years from now or 500 million years from now. Well, an enormous amount of things are going to happen in the meantime. And even in the next 50 years, we could be doing very serious, risky behavior for our planet. And, for example, I'm going to go jump in the Potomac River next Saturday to help raise money for a cause to try to increase people's awareness of climate change. So I thank Milton for the question.
Thank you, Milton. Yes, thank you, Peter. Let's go to, I wanted to hear from John. John had an interesting question about the solar system. Welcome to the show, John.
Yeah, Dan, I'd like your guest to speculate. I know it's just speculation, but what existed before the Big Bang? You can't have something from nothing. What existed before the Bang?
Peter,
I'll take the answer off the air.
All right. Who wants to? Peter, you want to go on that? And then I'll.
I would very much love to punt that one to Lee because I have no idea.
Well, I think that what it comes down to is it does seem more of a philosophical question than a scientific one. So I might just want to leave it at that and say that, yeah.
Well, it gets me to that question about whether we there was a question I had here about where other planets are in their development, because I think that's one of the most interesting points you make in the book, Lee, is that we might not know a potentially habitable exoplanet when we see one.
That's true. And we think that based on what we already know about the history of life on Earth. Life seems to have gotten started here relatively quickly after the Earth formed some 4.5 billion years ago. It seemed to basically as soon as the Earth cooled from all the great impacts that from which it was assembled, it seems like life kind of sprang up. And there's been this huge history, obviously, of life and its slow, gradual evolution. But what people a lot of times forget is that, or what they don't know about in the first place, is that for billions of years in the first part of its life, life really didn't do very much on Earth. It kind of just sat around. It didn't really progress very far from single-celled sludge. And, of course, we had this this great revolution in the biosphere, the rise of oxygen in the atmosphere and the rise of complex life. But for billions of years before that, it was somewhat of a so-called cryptic biosphere, in that if you looked at it from very far away and you're looking for oxygen, you would only see the barest traces. You'd see things like methane and organic hazes. And that's a lot trickier to really work out whether or not that's life, because we know of abiotic, purely geological things that could produce those sorts of signatures. So it's a complex question. And of course, no one really knows the full answer. We just have to go out and look.
I agree with that. And I wanted to add, just as evidence for that sort of blinkers on our scientific looking at things, the discovery of planets, the history of that, is such that people that were looking for it, for example, in the United States, Jeff Marcy is one of the leaders of that, and you profile him and Paul Butler in the book. He was looking for Jupiter-sized planets, and I was a graduate student at the time he was beginning this, and he told me one of the most important parts of this is to stay healthy so we can last long enough to see many orbits of a Jupiter-sized planet, which would be many decades. And yet he missed the first discovery of an exoplanet because even though it was sitting there in his data, he wasn't looking for things with four-day periods, for example. And so the European Michel Mayor gets credit for that discovery.
Excuse me, what did you mean by four-day periods?
So the planet goes around the star in 4 days.
Oh, I get you. Okay.
Yeah. So I like to tell children that means they get a birthday every 4 days.
Every 4 days. He wasn't looking for that. That activity, the wobble, the movement.
He had it in his data, and within weeks after the discovery announced by Mayor, he was able to report additional discoveries. But I wanted to also say that Bruce Campbell was doing that work before any of those, and I wanted to ask Lee, if you don't mind, Lee, why did he not show up in the book?
That's a very good question. It basically comes down to it was kind of tough to really get too deep into a lot of these earlier efforts because, you know, once you start talking about Bruce Campbell, should we talk about Peter Van de Kamp? Should we talk about various other figures who have now, of course, Campbell found a legit planet back in at least I believe he did. It was in his data or other people. You can look at David Latham. He found what in hindsight appears to be a planet or maybe a brown dwarf, depending upon – that's a so-called failed star, depending upon where you draw the line and where what makes a planet and what makes a star. There are all these various or you can look at the pulsar planets that were found by various folks, even before Marcy. So there was a rich history before that, and I didn't want to get too bogged down in going into the fine details of that sort of stuff and losing readers basically making them think that they would – yeah, that – I didn't want anyone to put the book down, basically.
Yeah. Let's go to another caller in Ruxton. Mark, you're on Midday Next. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was wondering if either of your guests has any thoughts on what's called Fermi's paradox. Enrico Fermi, who was a nuclear physicist, gave some thought to the possibility of extraterrestrial life with what we know now are millions, maybe billions of galaxies, not even counting stars, the likelihood should be pretty high that there's other intelligent life out there. But we haven't gotten any messages or visits. So the paradox that he articulated could be resolved if you said once civilizations reach a certain stage in their development, they self-destruct.
We got evidence for that right here.
Yeah, I guess I would say that, Fermi wasn't the first person to talk about these things. It's really a much deeper history to this question of where is everybody. And so I think sometimes people will get too attached to that one narrative, that one story, and forget about, the rich history that exists around these deep questions. So, for instance, I mean, that's one criticism of the book. People would say, well, there's no mention of Fermi's paradox. Well, actually, the whole book is about Fermi's paradox. It's just not called Fermi's paradox because it's a little deeper than just Fermi. There's other takes, too. It may not even come to civilizations destroying themselves, potentially. There's also fundamental things we don't understand about the origins of life. Life itself could be a very, very rare phenomenon. And it's one of these interesting divides you get when you ask, let's say, an astronomer or a geologist what they think about the origin of life and how likely it is versus what maybe a molecular biologist would think. And sometimes they'll give you very different answers. And I think that's somewhat telling about just how little we really still know about it.
So I just wanted to add that another way out of that is that space travel may be very much more difficult than we think. And the distances, again, are enormous. So when you think that, yes, maybe we'll be able to go to Mars, I don't mean you, Lee. I mean, in general, people thinking that we may go to Mars, oh, that's barely scratching the surface to the nearest star. Yeah. And so interstellar space travel, as Fermi had posited, may be much more difficult than anyone thinks.
George is in Edgewood, and he's our next caller. Go right ahead, George.
Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. There was a very good program on NOVA just not long ago about planet detection, and one of the things they talked about was Kepler telescope going dark. Is there anything that can be done about that, or is there any plans to do anything?
Yes.
Answer off the air.
Thank you for the question, George. The Kepler mission continues on with two avenues. One, the data are already on Earth from 4 years, and it will take us a long time to pour through that. In fact, a graduate student of mine, Veselin Kostov, will be announcing a new discovery from that very soon. Mission itself as a satellite is still operational with the two gyroscopes that are still working, reaction wheels. And the mission will probably, I hope anyway, be funded to continue a number of years in that state where it has to point in a direction different from the one that it had previously chosen to point at. But that will allow us to observe about a dozen new Kepler fields with a lot more interesting discoveries coming from that. Let's keep our fingers crossed for that.
Yes. Lee, I had one more question for you because you spent so much time visiting with scientists who are looking for life on other planets. Is there any sort of common personality trait among those scientists that made them take this particular branch of planetary science up?
That's a great question, Dan, and the answer is yes. They have indomitable will, it seems like, and curiosity and passion for what they do. They're pioneers. They don't want to take no for an answer. One person in particular that I talk about quite a lot in the book is Sarah Seeger, a professor at MIT. And one thing I like to say every now and then about her is that if you tell her that something's impossible, that's just like throwing gasoline on a fire. She's going to try to figure out a way to do it, to do the impossible. And it's not just her. It's something that I think is – and it's not even just exoplanets. I think this is something that just occurs somewhat naturally whenever you're pioneering and opening up a new field of scientific inquiry. You're going to have these sorts of spirits, these personality types drawn to it.
It's the human spirit, basically.
That's right.
Lee Billings is a science journalist whose work has appeared in Nature, New Scientist, Popular Mechanics, and Scientific American. He lives in New York. This is his first book. I said his latest book. This is his first one. I want to congratulate you on this. You've gotten some excellent reviews, and we really like this book and recommend it.
Thank you.
It's called 5 Billion Years of Solitude, The Search for Life Among the Stars, Lee Billings. Its publisher is Current. Thank you, Lee.
Thank you, Dan. And Peter.
And Peter. And Peter McCullough, who joined us today from the Hubble Telescope Project over at Hopkins. Thank you for being here, Peter. And by the way,
you're very much welcome.
Yeah. I don't know if it'll occur again, but it must occur again. Last night there was an amazing full moon.
Yep. Did you? It'll occur every month.
Yeah, I heard that. So I'm going to look for it again in a month or so. By the way, is something you wanted to...
Yeah, I just wanted to shout out to my daughter who's 16 years old today.
What's her name?
Oh.
Lisa.
Lisa?
Yep.
All right, Lisa, happy birthday. And thank
happy
you, Peter.
Happy birthday, Lisa.
Yeah, way to go. Lee, thank you again. Thanks, everybody. And thanks, everyone who listened and who contributed to today's show. We'll see you again on Monday.
Midday's senior producer is Nikki Gamer. The producer and director is John Ahrens. The associate producer is Michael Himowitz. Our interns are Jason Van Slyke, Luke Spicknell, Lawrence Bass, and Maya Brown. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.